Hope you like that. It's one of my all-time favorite jazz instrumentals. What I like about it is just the sheer exuberance and joy and life. Of course, these were three all-time great players. Some of you will know them, Dizzy Gillespie, Sonny Rollins, and Sonny Stitt. It's called the Eternal Triangle. And if they ever have a memorial service for me, I hope this will be played at the end so people can dance out or have a smile on their face when they leave. So when I was preparing this talk, I included the Oxfording Bodhisattva who, as you remember, has just returned to the marketplace. And that's the picture that's being passed around or was passed around to everybody. You can see that he's a plump, laughing dude. And interestingly, he bears a striking resemblance to Hōtai, the Japanese laughing Buddha, or the god of happiness and contentment. He seems to be embracing life joyfully. He doesn't appear to have missed many meals. And importantly, he always carries around a gourd of rice wine. So I thought this song would fit right in with his image. Now, a few weeks ago, Frank called me, and interestingly, his name is Hōtai, which, knowing Frank, I think is quite apropos. Anyway, he called me to ask about the title of my talk to put into the newsletter. And I hemmed and I hawed, and then I finally said, "Creating a Culture of Awakening." As I wrote my notes, I thought to myself, what the heck? That title sounds way too serious. I think I'll call it The Zen of Whitewater Rafting. So what does Hōtai have to do with whitewater rafting? We'll see. But before we get to whitewater rafting, I want to expand on a brief talk I gave some months ago, which was about ELSA. That's not a Swedish girl. It's an acronym I will explain a little further on. ELSA is a rethink of the Four Noble Truths as actually being a fourfold task, as described in Stephen Batchelor's book, After Buddhism. It's based mainly on the Pali Canon, the suttas that were the most immediate after the Buddha's death. It seeks to reflect his teachings after stripping out what was also common to Brahmanism, or early Hinduism, and Jainism at the time, and focuses on what may have been the Buddha's original commentary before centuries of interpretation and reinterpretation, and it removes the mythological aspects. So why think, rethink? Why not? We often talk about how Buddhism has been readapted to various cultures and worldviews. Just look at all the schools of Buddhism today. So why not attempt to look at the historicity and origination of this religion philosophy? Here we are in our modern world, and it seems all of us in this room are highly fortunate just to be living in this time and place. Since 500 BCE, worldviews have changed beyond imagining, even during our own lifetimes. Today, we have, at least in the Western world, become more of a secular society, much shorn of religiosity. We are democracies rather than kingdoms or totalitarian states. We're decently educated, and we have more faith in science than in the old bearded fellow in the sky. And yet, how do we genuinely live our lives in this here and now based on our Zen practice? And that's where ELSA comes in. ELSA is an acronym for E, embrace life, L, let go of reactivity, S, see the ceasing of reactivity, and A, act by cultivating the Eightfold Path. So to embrace life is really an open-hearted embrace of our total existence. To embrace life includes, as Mr. Batchelor puts it, to not only comprehend or understand dukkha, but to comprehend or understand every aspect of life, its pain and pleasure, its suffering and joy, the whole thing. And importantly, life's contingent, impermanent nature. Dogen wrote this: "Those who see the worldly life as an obstacle to Dharma see no Dharma in everyday actions. They have not yet discovered that there are no everyday actions outside of Dharma." So what are we comprehending in this dukkha? Simply the ending of, you've heard it before, greed, the ending of anger, the ending of ignorance or delusion. And so how do we end these three? First, by letting go of reactivity. That is, letting go of our habitual reactive patterns of thought and behavior. You see, dukkha is not caused by life. It's our unhealthy reaction to it. And the Buddha said this about reactivity: craving, which is repetitive, wallows in attachment and greed, obsessively indulges in this and that, craving for stimulation, craving for existence, craving for non-existence. Those are the myriad reactions that life provokes in us. It's our own habitual impulsivity. Next, S, by seeing the ceasing of reactivity. Mr. Batchelor writes, "The ceasing is to be beheld." And what is this ceasing? It's the traceless fading away and ending of reactivity, the letting go and abandoning of it, freedom and independence from it. And nirvana itself can be seen as this freedom and independence from reactivity. So we begin to be aware of nirvana whenever greed, anger, and delusion are momentarily inactive. Momentarily. And finally, by acting, by cultivating the Eightfold Path. In the framework of the fourfold task, this nirvanic freedom is not the goal of the Eightfold Path, but its beginning. This path doesn't stretch out ahead into the distance, waiting for us to take a leisurely stroll along it. It requires our ongoing care and application from moment to moment. And what about this Eightfold Path? Mr. Batchelor uses the term complete rather than right to suggest, as he puts it, complete vision, complete ideas, complete speech, action, forms of life, resolve, mindfulness, and focused awareness are integral parts of the whole. One could also say wise or even authentic vision, action, ideas, speech. Complete differentiates from the idea of correct or free from error in favor of wholeness and authenticity. Importantly, he says, cultivating the Eightfold Path is grounded in mindful awareness that leads one to become self-reliant in the practice of Dharma. So this fourfold task can be seen as one continuous effort in which we practice all four tasks together, since we never really leave the world of dukkha, and we never completely relinquish elements of our own reactivity. So there it is. Continuous practice, course of action, embracing life totally. So where do we go from here? The Buddha referred to path followers also as stream entrants. It's a metaphor implying we are no longer stuck in our habitual behavior of craving, clinging, grasping. We have become free to flow along with the stream. Now, for purposes of this talk, this is where I depart a little from this allegory, as I see the eight practices as the banks of a river that guide our freedom to greater maturity, to greater genuineness, and toward an integrated life. And I see entering the river as going white water rafting rather than floating lazily along. So to me, this path or river is not some ideal to be achieved. Rather, it's, even though it's a river, down to earth, pragmatic, here and now, down to earth, right in the midst of all of it, right in the hurly-burly. We aren't going to escape the reality of the here and now. as Shakespeare puts it, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. But we can work at finding the balance, the middle way, to not being caught up by this constantly shifting perplexity called life. This is what the fourfold task is about, fully embracing life. Now there's another aspect to stream entry, which is that the paper won't stay up. As we begin to let go of reactivity, another awareness, a space may begin to unfold for us. And as I said, nirvana can simply be considered as that unfolding. As this process begins to happen, maybe a space starts to open for us, or maybe the mind fog begins to clear, and we begin to realize an emptiness that was already there. Was that Kensho? Was I beginning to see my true nature? Whatever, it is a conceptually ungraspable experience which I would term ineffable. There it was, or it was momentarily. Now some describe it as a silence, a stillness, an emptiness, a brilliance, and to me, an aliveness. Yet this ineffable is nothing we can grasp at. Nothing we can grasp at. Grasping after it is like trying to grab a tree branch as we flow down the river, grasping at and craving the ineffable. And suddenly we're stuck back in the same old place. And although our practice is not focused on something to be achieved, there can be results to this mindful cultivation of the way. Jishin discussed them a few weeks ago. The Brahma Viharas, the four immeasurables, selfless joy, equanimity, compassion, loving kindness. Now look at those Viharas, because this is important. It's not about me. They are about those around us and how we express fully the Dharma to them. Now Vihara means to dwell or abide in. Abide in the four immeasurables. Abide in the here and now as a living, sensing human being. Abide in emptiness. But this abiding is not some metaphysical trance-like state. As Mr. Batchelor writes, to abide in emptiness means to inhabit fully the embodied space of one's sensory experience, but freed of our habitual reactivity. The point is not to understand emptiness, but to abide in it. To abide in emptiness brings us firmly down to earth and back in our bodies, cultivating our own true nature. Now, I've wrestled with this term emptiness, and I'm sure many of you have. It's just another word. Then I thought of Gotama's first awakening or Kensho experience as an 8-year-old sitting under a tree near an open field while harvest is taking place, surrounded by life, maybe a big open sky, maybe a gentle breeze, maybe the smell of the earth or the grass, the murmuring of workers in the field. And what came to mind for me was not emptiness, but openness or boundlessness. For me, that puts a different flavor to it all. Boundlessness, openness, freedom unhindered by my cravings, the ability to respond appropriately right here and now. Experiencing deeply what I see, hear, taste, smell, touch, or am mindful of without preconceptions. Now, as you might suspect, none of this practice, none of these fruits comes easily. The banks of our river may be there to provide direction, but that doesn't mean to say there are no obstacles or challenges. Class 3, 4, or 5 rapids if you've ever been whitewater rafting. Tree stumps and boulders in the way, eddies and whirlpools, you name it. The world of dukkha and our inherent reactivity are the rapids and the turbulence of life roaring around us. I know this can all sound like serious business, yet what does the Song of Zazen say? Our dancing and songs are the voice of the Dharma.
We don't just sit there like this all day.
Or as Thomas Merton puts it, we are invited to forget ourselves on purpose, cast our awful solemnity to the winds, and join in the general dance. And here, what sprung to mind was big, plump, laughing Hotai, come back to the marketplace, firmly down to earth, embracing life. And our song ends like this. Nirvana is openly shown to our eyes. This earth where we stand is the pure lotus land, and this very body, the body of Buddha. And our happy Hotai? Well, he's in town to arrange a whitewater rafting expedition with us. And here we are in this marketplace, waiting for him, back in the middle of it all. Here we are with freedom to respond to life from a more selfless perspective, to mutually respond to the challenges in and around us all. So it's time to hit the rapids with Hotai, and we do this together. First, however, we need to inspect our raft. This is a different raft from that one used across a stream and abandoned. And it's different from boats or wooden rafts. Our raft is designed for white water. First, it's lightweight. We can all easily pick it up together. Second, it is tough, built to take a lot of punishment. Third, it is flexible and resilient. Lightweight and not a burden. Tough, flexible, and resilient. Maybe like our Dharma practice, I hope. And us rafters, well, we might range from experienced to beginners. Experienced rafters have learned a lot of the skills of rafting. How to sit correctly on the raft. How to paddle back and how to back paddle the right way. How to shift weight. How to read the water and anticipate what may be coming ahead. And importantly, what to do when one falls out. There's an art to all of this. The most expert may be the steerer who knows this particular river and how it flows in all different seasons and conditions, like Hotai. Yeah, and can you imagine him in a wetsuit and life preserver if you looked at that picture? Well, don't even imagine me in one either. And yes, there's a technique when we fall out or get ejected from the raft. The thing to do is to just relax. Just relax. Cross your feet and arms. Point those feet downstream. No flailing about, just relaxing into it. And the life vest keeps you afloat with your head above the water. Sort of like your own practice, I hope. Eventually, you come to a calmer spot and can be pulled back into the raft. Now, I've fallen out a few times myself. So there we are on this Dharma raft in frigid water, fitted out in our wetsuits, helmets, and life vests, paddling and steering with all our might around obstacles and turbulence. And there we are dealing with what is at hand, bouncing around, getting soaked, working with others, sometimes people we don't necessarily know, beginners and experienced, but working with them to steer around those obstacles. And when we fall out of the raft, there are hands reaching out to help pull us back aboard. Now, people who go whitewater rafting do so because they choose to. They know it will be a challenge, but they're in it for the joy of the challenge. So here it is, our Dharma practice, a challenge freely entered into. Here we are, fully embracing life. You know, we get through one rapid or by one obstacle, there's a bunch of cheering and fist pumping. And don't forget, Hotai brought a gourd full of rice wine. In a sense, this is what building a culture of awakening is about in all this turbulence of life. We're all on this raft together. Here we are, becoming free, self-reliant, autonomous human beings, yet at the same time recognizing mutuality and community as a basis for our practice. The Buddha's final words were, "You must be a lamp unto yourselves and work out your own liberation with great diligence." But we can't do that without being in community, without those friendships and relationships. What good would the viharas be without others? Those gifts of mindfulness and discernment to freely give away. So finally, to me, this all-encompassing fourfold task brings a deepening awareness of our true nature, of our ordinary mind. And I want to end with a quote from Thomas Merton. Although it's from a contemplative Christian perspective, I think in many ways it pretty much says it all. Of course, I love this thing, and that's why it's in this talk. In Louisville, on the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people, that they were mine and I was theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. I have the immense joy of being human. As if the sorrows and stupidities of the human condition could overwhelm me now that I realize what we all are. If only everybody could realize this. But it cannot be explained. There is no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun. All Buddhas.